Welcome to the XYZ Experiment podcast. It's Darsh and Fiona here. And today we have Tara Crowe on our podcast. Welcome, Tara.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you.
I met Tara through Leadership Victoria when we were talking about me coming doing some talking with their group. And Leadership Victoria, both Darsh and I did their Williamson Leadership Program in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was talking to Tara, I just couldn't get over how fascinating your story was, Tara. Like really, really interesting. And I thought it would be fantastic to have you on the podcast and talk a little bit about that and talk about your role at Leadership Victoria and what sort of things you're doing and what led you there. I'm really interested in that story as well. So, Tara, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, thanks, Fiona. Well, I'm a girl from the burbs. My mum and dad, I always start off the story saying that I'm the eldest of two eldests. So my mum and dad were both eldest children and they had me when they were quite young. My mum was 22. And I think that they didn't really know anything about being parents, but they led by their instincts. And I really feel like that's something that they passed on to me throughout my life. Grew up in Melbourne, outer suburbs. And then when I think I was about seven, we headed off to East Gippsland. And my dad was a copper and he decided he wanted to go back to where he grew up. And he said to my mum, "You're going to do it. We're just going to be there for a year." And we ended up being there for 8 years. So I feel like I have a bit of sensibilities of a country person, but at the same time, the street smarts of a city person as well. Came back to Melbourne when I was about 15 and did my schooling. And really, like, honestly, I remember back, my dad just telling me one day when I was about, I think I was about 9 or 10, he introduced me to his golfing buddy and said, "This is going to be the first female Prime Minister of Australia." And I thought, at the time I went,
I love that.
Hell yeah, I can do whatever I want. And I think that was how I was raised. Like, I wasn't raised in a super political family. We had no financial literacy, like none of these things, but we had confidence that we could kind of do whatever we wanted to do. And so I've kind of just lived my life like, oh yeah, I can do that. Oh yeah, I can do that.
Yeah.
Oh, I could head off and do that.
It's a bit fearless.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's stupidity or it's confidence. Like, what do they say? Confidence is just the knowing of that you've done it before.
Yeah.
But I've done lots of things in my life that I've never done before and I've felt pretty confident about it as I went into it. So maybe it's a bit arrogance. I'm not sure.
No.
I don't know.
I feel like listening to you, it's just kind of like, she'll be right.
Yeah. I guess I had resilience from a pretty young age. My mum and dad told us that we could do what we wanted to do. You know, we were good at sport, pretty good at school, good kids. Like, I remember having a conversation with my mum, like, "Oh God, I must have been an awful teenager." She said, "No, you were fine." You were like just so... She always knew what was going on with me. And so I've always been a bit of an open book as well, which is good. But yeah, I think when I was about 22, I decided I was going to go and get a one-way ticket to London, as a lot of Australians do, and went over there and decided to get a job in PR. Had no idea really what that was about. But when I told my friends I'm working in PR, they're, "Oh, of course you are. Of course. Like, that's exactly what you should be doing." And I was like, okay, well, I guess that's pretty good then. Yeah, went to night school and just wasn't really quite driven that I'm going to do something with this life. And I thought I was going to live in London forever. Honestly, I applied for a British passport because my mum, another part of the story, my mum was born in Kenya. So she had a British passport when she was young and she said, go off to England and, you know, maybe they'll give you a British passport and you can stay there. And it turns out they didn't want me to stay. So I got deported.
Seriously?
Yeah. Got sent back to Australia. I was like, oh God, I've got to start again. And then, you know, kept working in PR. And I think that around, it must have been about 25 or something, I started to really think about what my values were. And I remember that being a bit of a change for me, that what do I really value in life? Mm. And where do my values come from? And what's important to me? And why am I here? And I took a bit of a change from Collins Street PR girl to working for World Vision.
Yeah.
Which was a big shift, really big shift. And that kind of then started to frame up, okay, this is what I'm passionate about. Social issues, people living in poverty, like what could I do about that? Like, I'm just a girl from the burbs, but what could I really do? So working for World Vision really opened up my eyes to that.
So we might like start to come to that. But before we go much further, I'm now really curious because I can't pick it. What generation do you belong to?
Well, I had to actually check this morning, but I'm a Y. So I was born...
You're a millennial.
Yeah, millennial. Yeah. So I was born in 1980.
Yeah. Okay.
But I don't feel like I am.
You seem very Gen X to me.
I know. Yeah. That's why I was a bit confused.
Because yes. When she was just starting that story, I was just thinking, oh, my God, that's my story.
Yeah.
The Gen X story. Yeah.
But I think that is because my parents are... I feel like we were both kind of similar,
yeah,
because they were young parents.
Ooh.
And they are X, but yeah, I feel like I'm an X as well. Yeah.
Well, 1980 is also a cusp.
Yeah, you're what we call a geriatric millennial.
Oh, great. Well, matches my geriatric wart that I've got on my face that my doctor told me.
The other words they
that's
use
hilarious.
What's the other way that they call it?
A zennial.
Cross between
I like
Gen X and
I'm
going to
be a zennial. I'm a zennial.
Yeah, a zennial.
Because I think my parents also, there's something about, and I don't know if you agree, something about like when you're living in the country, you are maybe a little bit, I don't want to offend all the country, but you're a little bit behind the curve a little bit as well. So they were both raised in regional Victoria, and so then we moved back to regional Victoria, and I think we just had this very kind of, maybe a little bit behind.
Is it behind or is it, because I lived in the country for 20 years, is it different values?
Yeah.
About what's important in life?
Maybe.
You know, just different sort of importance of what you put the importance on.
Less things to conflict you with.
Yeah.
That's
almost
sound
a simpler
reactive.
Life, and I know country people don't live a simple life, but... It's different, I think. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like I'm a zennial.
You're a
zennial. I think so too.
Yeah. And listening to that story, I feel like that came through. So we won't necessarily then, unless there is something you feel is very zennial about you that you wanted to share.
Look, we've just defined it in my mind, so I'll think about it as the podcast go on.
Okay.
So what we didn't hear just then is you spent 10 years working in Tanzania.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that and what drew you to working with that.
Yeah, I think so. My mum was actually born in Kenya. Mm-hmm. So my family's got a history of their white Anglo background, but they were living in Kenya. And so my mum, she came to Australia when she was 8 years old on a boat from Africa. And
wow.
Her and her two sisters and her dad. So her dad had got custody of the three girls and decided to come to live in Australia. And I think he was a botanist. And so he came, he got a job at Melbourne University.
Mm-hmm.
And he was raising these three girls after living in Kenya pretty much his whole life. I think it was quite forming for my mum. She really romanticised about what her life in Kenya was like and what it was like and what her family was like. And then I grew up and... To me, it just seemed like this massive part of me. Like, I just knew that I was going to go to Africa, that I was going to go back to East Africa. I loved African music. We had African art in our house. I gravitated towards people from Africa. Like, I really felt like it was part of me. And I don't know what that is because I'm, you know, you can't see me, but I am very much a white woman.
Mm.
And so when I was working at World Vision, I feel like it started to open up that idea that, you know, you could go and work overseas. But I wasn't sure that working for World Vision overseas was the right thing for me. And then one day my friend invited me to this Rotary Club event and said, there's a woman from Tanzania who's coming to talk about her school that she started. And I thought, that sounds interesting.
Mm.
So I went up and when she was finished her talk, I went over to her and I spoke Swahili with her because my mum had always kind of told us a few words in Swahili. So I greeted her, habari yako, and she was like taken aback that she was in, I think we're in Keysborough, like you couldn't be more Melbourne suburban, you know, it was just so strange. And then she said, I need a marketing team, like you should come over and start my marketing team and you should work for me in Tanzania, would you be interested? And I said, oh, I've got some big projects on at the moment at World Vision. But I went home to mum and dad that night because I was back living with them for a short while, and I said, I think I'm going to move to Tanzania. Yeah, I think 6 months later I was on a plane and I was moving to Tanzania, and I felt really supported because I had my aunt living in Kenya And I felt like I wasn't really, I felt like I was kind of going home.
Yeah.
In a way. Mm. So, yeah, I arrived and I did 10 months at the School of St. Jude, which is a really successful not-for-profit school for children from a really, really poor background in Tanzania. And I worked there for a while. And then, unfortunately, my mum then was diagnosed with breast cancer. So I came back to Australia and I was here to kind of help her through that diagnosis and some really horrible stuff. She ended up, we were told that she was going to be in remission then. So I said, look, I've got the bug. I've got to go back.
Yeah.
I've got to go back.
Yeah.
And she didn't like it. Yeah. We were very close. She didn't like it, but she said, okay.
Yeah.
And so I got a job running a safari company in Arusha, Tanzania, which was this dusty town. It's a town. There's a million people that live there. So it's a big city, but it's a dusty town. And I'd never been on safari in Tanzania. And I found myself working for a Tanzanian safari company. And my bosses were this wonderful people who came from a training background. So I think they knew that they could teach me the things that they needed to teach me. And it was really good education for me in that you're always learning, you're always growing, and that if you have good people around you and good influences and good teachers, that you can kind of can learn those things. Like, yeah, so then I started working for this safari company.
What was one of, like, the things you learnt which was, like, interesting?
I think for me it was, well, there was lots of things. I mean, I learnt about how to, the safety of a rifle, you know, and I learnt about how to put solar panels on tents in the Serengeti.
Wow.
And I learned about mountain climbing. So we did a lot of expeditions up Mount Kilimanjaro. So I climbed Kilimanjaro a couple of times. I learned about packing weights for tents, for porters to carry goods up a mountain. I learned about four-wheel driving. I learned about things that I'd never been exposed to in my life in
and
Australia.
And even the wildlife. Like, I mean, the wildlife in Tanzania is very different to the wildlife in Australia.
Absolutely.
So did you have to have, like, a crash course in this is what to expect of these different animals?
Yeah. And I worked in the office, but I spent a lot of time out in the Serengeti in the bush and in the Ngorongoro crater. And I went out and I became quite fascinated with birds and animals and the outdoors and just being outside. Like, you cannot live there and not be in love with nature. And so it really opened that up for me. And it kind of tapped into that kind of like that naturalist hippie kind of roots that I feel like I probably had somewhere in there. And every day was an adventure. Honestly, every day. I used to say it's like you felt like you were living life, the highs and the lows. You know, lots of horrible things happened and lots of wonderful things happened. You know, one day you could be having a gin and tonic on the balcony of a luxury resort looking out over a herd of elephants. And the next day, you know, you're stuck in traffic behind 500 cars in a traffic jam in Arusha and you can't get to where you're going, you know. So it was just interesting and,
wow.
Yeah, amazing. And I was forever changed.
Mm.
I am forever changed because of my time in Tanzania. And I thought, again, there was the second time in my life where I thought, I'm going to live here forever. This is where I'm going to live. Like, I really thought I was going to live in Tanzania for the rest of my life and I was going to be, I don't even like the term expat, but I started calling myself, I'm immigrating here.
Yeah.
But unfortunately in Tanzania, you actually can't really immigrate to Tanzania. It's really hard as an expat to kind of stay there, and you have to keep getting visas and proving yourself worthy to be there. There's no kind of immigration policy Yeah, so it was, yeah. It did come to an end, which is another very big story.
Why did it come to an end? If you can, happy to share that
story.
Yeah,
I found myself without a visa, without a work visa. It's very hard. You have to be sponsored. You can't just kind of go there and say, I'm going to find
work.
A job.
Yeah.
It's very, very different. It's so different to Australia. Like, everything is just so different. So I found myself without a work visa. I was in a relationship that had broken down. I had a 2-year-old daughter who was born in Tanzania, my beautiful, beautiful girl. And I realized that I couldn't stay there.
Mm.
I couldn't stay there anymore. I couldn't be the mom that I wanted to be. I couldn't be the woman that I knew that I needed to be.
Mm.
And so I left, very suddenly.
Mm.
And my dad had 3 days' notice that I was coming back to live with him with a toddler. And bless him, he said, see you at the airport. And I, and he was there at the airport, and I then started to rebuild myself again because I was very broken.
Yeah.
Very, very broken. I came back from a collective way of living where I had a four-bedroom house. I had a partner, albeit not a great relationship, but I had a network of friends and people, and I spoke Swahili, and I felt alive. But then also a part of me felt actually quite dead. Mm. You know, I felt like I'd probably learnt all I needed to learn from that place. Mm-hmm. And I was ready to come back to Australia. And I just wasn't sure if Australia was ready for me.
That's an interesting comment. Yeah. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I feel like I was this person who had changed, but I didn't know the people in Australia that were changed like me.
Yeah.
I would go to the park with my toddler and, "Hi, I'm Tara. How are you? Blah, blah, blah. I've just come back from Tanzania. Blah, 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 blah." And people would look at me like I was crazy. I wasn't, I couldn't find, I hadn't found my people, yeah. my tribe, my community. I was in the wrong place.
Yeah.
But in the right place.
How old were you at that point, Tara?
This was only 7 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. So I've only been back in Australia for 7 years. So my daughter is now 9. Okay. She's 2.5.
Yeah.
So I've had a very quick, again, another part of life has started, but in 7 years, a lot has happened again.
Finding your tribe is so important.
It's so important.
And particularly in your 30s. I feel like in your 30s is a time when you crave that, like, extended tribe.
Yeah. Because quite often you find your tribe through your children.
Yes.
Like mothers' groups and school and things like that. How did you find your tribe? Have you found your tribe?
I have found my tribe. Yeah. I have very much found my tribe. So I was living with my dad in the southeastern suburbs when we first came back, and I didn't know what I was going to do for a job. Yeah. You know, I had this amazing experience. I'd been running a safari company in Tanzania. I was managing up to 400 men. I was speaking a different language. I was learning all these things. But what does that do in Melbourne? Like, what is that? I used to have the really funny comments. Like, people would say to me, "You should go work at the zoo." And I was like,
what
to do with it? But it was interesting how people didn't know how to relate to me. That's why I say, like, I feel like I was in the, I don't know if Melbourne was ready for me.
Yeah.
And it was actually after, it was actually around the time, I think if you remember the African gang saga.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the media kind of inflated these whole things that there was all these African gangs in Melbourne. And it was just a horrible time. I actually had a recruiter who said to me, "Maybe you should not say that you lived in Africa."
No.
Because of the African gang. And I say that like there was no African gangs.
No.
There was some people, you know, and people that probably really needed some support.
100%.
And so this recruiter said to me, "Maybe you shouldn't say that you're in Africa." I was like, "Well, what am I going to say that I was doing for all this time? Like, this is crazy."
Holiday?
Yeah, I just took a break. Yeah, so I came back. That's why I think I wasn't sure where to find my people. So I was living in the southeastern suburbs. I had a young child who, her whole life had been changed. Mm. You know, one minute she's got a nanny and a gardener and a maid and a mum and a dad, and she was going to this lovely little bush kinder with a three-legged sheep and, you know, hedgehogs in the garden. And next minute we're in the suburbs of Melbourne with her babu, with her granddad, that she didn't really know very well. Mm. They really know each other really well now, though, and they have an amazing relationship, which is great. And my dad, I don't even know if he had ever changed my nappy when I was a kid, but he had to learn pretty quick to help out. And we stayed with him for about 7 months, and then I said, "I don't think this is where I'm meant to be in Melbourne." Yeah. So we moved over to the west.
Ah.
Yeah. So
what, Perth?
No, west of Melbourne.
Oh, west of Melbourne. Sorry,
oh my God, you are so funny.
You're thinking sick. West of Australia. Okay,
you're such a Perth-oriented
You're such a Perth girl, Fiona. No, to the western suburbs of Melbourne. So, my
which is very African.
Yes. So at this point, I needed to be around people who understood what collective community, collective ways of being was going to be like. And I figured, my brother actually had bought a house in Footscray, so I was like, okay, I think I'm going to move to the inner west. You know, I think that that'd be good. At least I can speak Swahili.
Yeah, at least
I can, you know, greet people. And it was very naive of me to think that I was going to be walking around the street speaking Swahili with people. But I really felt like I needed that. I needed diversity. I needed something different. I needed people who were going to say hi back to me on the street.
Yeah.
And I just hadn't found that around where my dad was living. So I moved. And my brother said, "Oh, it's going to take you ages to find a house. Like, it's really hard to get rentals. You're never going to find anywhere." And I took Inara and I got in the car and drove over there, and I went to two places. And this woman said, "Oh, this place has already been taken." And I was like, "Oh, maybe I'm not going to find anywhere." She goes, "But there's a place upstairs, and it's my cousin's. And I've been waiting for someone like you to come along. So do you want it?" And I said, "Yep." And we found a house and we moved in, and it just happened to be right next door to the primary school that my daughter now goes to. And yeah, I definitely found my community. It took a while, and COVID, that horrible period where you couldn't really find community.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, we were all in this thing together.
Yeah.
And I know it was a really horrible time for a lot of people, but it actually wasn't that hard for me, because I knew what it was like to be isolated, and I knew what it was like to go to the supermarket and not have anything there. And I knew what it was like for a lot of people in Tanzania, where I'd just come from, that they didn't have the luxuries that we had. And so emotionally, and it wasn't that hard for me to be at home with a toddler wondering. I kind of didn't need to have any FOMO then, because no one else was doing anything. So yeah. I couldn't do anything because I was a single parent, you know. So, yeah, it was an interesting time. But now I have this wonderful community in the inner west of Melbourne, in Footscray. And, I definitely have found my people. And so, yeah, I was all right. And we came out of COVID. And thankfully, the Victorian government allowed, I think, the children of single parents could still go to kinder. And so she had a normal kind of normal-ish kind of life. And I had found a job and I was working from home. And so, like, we muddled through it. It's a really tough time, because I don't know if being a single parent is really hard.
Yeah.
It's, the world is not actually designed to be a solo parent.
Mm. Yeah.
And you can't, I used to say, like, I can't do anything by myself. Mm. Like, I didn't have someone that every second weekend was coming to pick her up, or I didn't have someone else to talk to about the milestones in her life. Mm. And so that was really probably the hardest part for me.
And you're working at the same time.
And I was working, and I was going through my own, I was unpacking my own traumas.
Yeah.
You know, I was working through my own stuff. I was healing from a really bad relationship, leaving behind a world that I thought was my world, having to reinvent myself and find, like, what is my purpose here in Australia? What am I going to do with all this experience and this drive that I have? But I couldn't really go as fast as I wanted to go, you know? Like, I wanted to go and network with people, but you can't network when you're a single parent. I wanted to go and try these jobs, but I couldn't go more than 20 minutes from her, because honestly, physically, I think I would just break down if I was that far away from her. So it was that was tough. And then I realized, I had this big awakening that I think I'm gay. And I went to this queer event, and I remember just being so excited that I was going to be around a whole bunch of women, lesbians and queer people. And I thought, I am not straight. And I don't think I'd really, really allowed myself to think about that much, particularly living in a country where it's illegal to be queer, to be gay. And so it opened another chapter in my
life. You found another tribe.
Another tribe and another chapter and another life.
Yeah.
And so I then started dating women.
Yeah.
And I'm now engaged to the most beautiful, beautiful woman who is, just everything that I have ever wanted but didn't know that I need, like, didn't know that was there.
Yeah.
That's a huge thing to come back to Australia after all those years and then going through that, but then also going through something else. Like, how do you suddenly realise, like, that's hard? That's hard. Because you would have been dealing with so much. And then that comes up too.
Yeah, yeah. And, it was another thing. And I remember saying to my dad, my lovely dad, I remember saying to him, "Dad, I'm gay." I at the time I identified as bisexual. I said, "I'm bisexual." He goes, "Oh yeah, oh, well, you've done a lot of other things, so... You know, like, that's all. And he has never, like, my dad and my mum, bless my mum passed away 11 years ago, so she's not with us anymore. But they just never said, you should do that, or I told you so.
Because,
or,
you can do anything.
Because you can do anything.
Yeah.
He's just, you know,
what
we don't.
What a wonderful world.
Yeah. And he, we have problems. You know, we talk about political things. We're not always aligned, but he's always kind of thought, oh, yeah, Tara can do that.
Yeah.
And I think he's just so happy that I'm happy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's kind of supported and gone through a bit of a journey. And, yeah, I started dating women, and I realised I'm in this queer new tribe, new community, new scene. And but I'm a single mum, and I live in West Footscray, and I've, you know, got a job. Like, who am I? Like, I was just all these things. And then, yeah, I started realizing I needed to do some things for myself as well. I think that's like a lot of mothers. They start to, you start to regain a little bit of who you were before. And so when I was young, sport was a really big thing in my life. And I'd always played basketball and been quite into sport. And I said, I'm going to go back and play sport. And my dad and my brother said, what are you doing? You've had two back surgeries. I think I was 39 or something at the time. Like, what are you doing? Why are you going to go do that? That sounds crazy. And I was like, no, I'm going to go do this. I really, really, really need this. And I joined a women's over 35 basketball team. And Ara, my daughter, I would pack her dinner so that she could eat her dinner while she was sitting on the bench watching me play basketball.
Yeah.
Because there was no one at home to look after
her. And there's some late night games.
And the games were all about 5 or 6. And at that time, she was going to bed about 6:30. So she'd have showered in her pajamas, sitting on the court, eating her dinner while I was playing basketball. And I thought I was nailing life.
I love that, though.
And the rest of the team were like, oh, this is our hour away from our family. Like, this is, and I was like, well, and Ara's going to learn how to play basketball because she's going to be watching me.
What a wonderful thing for her to witness, though.
It is, and I still make her come and watch me.
But there's my mum doing it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. She still comes and watches me every Sunday.
Yeah.
I make her come because I do so much for her.
Yeah.
And mothers, you know, the lesson I think for this is that mothers do so much for their children. That where's our support?
Mm. Yeah.
Where's our clap after the win or commiserate, you know, or pat on the back when you've done a good job? So I wanted to teach her that she needs to come and look after me as well.
But that's really profound because I often, you know, even thinking of my own childhood or listening to a few podcasts about raising children, I don't have children, mind you, and just children can be incredibly selfish and self-absorbed. Mm-hmm. And you're almost breaking that narrative with your daughter and saying, no, you're going to be my cheerleader here.
Yes. And now she's learning how to score and she's being useful, you know.
Yeah.
And her friends do now come along and, like, my team members' kids come along. But in the beginning, it was just her. And she'd sit there and she'd be like, oh, I need to go to the toilet. I'd be like, well, you'll have to wait. And then someone else would take, you know, it just had to. We had to get on with it. You know, she had to come everywhere with me. But doing that thing for myself and going to play basketball actually saved my life.
Mm. Because in what ways?
I got elbowed in the ribs and I thought, I've got a broken rib. I better go and get an x-ray. And I did have a broken rib, but I also had lung cancer that they found.
Oh, my gosh.
So I had no symptoms apart from being tired, which I was a single mum. So, of course, I was tired.
Of course.
But they found a tumour in my lung.
Had you been a smoker or anything like that? Everyone would ask that question.
Exactly.
I'm sure. Yeah.
I had had a cigarette every now and again at a party.
Yeah.
You know,
Nothing serious.
I was a big party girl when I was young, but I wasn't a smoker.
Yeah.
I wasn't someone, and even the doctor said to me, this is not because of smoking.
Most aren't, I think. Yeah.
I was 41 and I was diagnosed with stage 3 lung cancer.
That's pretty serious.
Yeah.
Lucky you broke the rib.
Lucky I went to play basketball. Lucky I did that thing for myself.
Yeah.
You know, lucky I joined that team. Just literally, this woman just said, oh, you're tall. Do you play basketball? You should come and play with us. And I said, yeah, I do. I will.
Mm.
I'll go do that because I can do that.
Yeah.
A few years ago, I had, a third of my lung taken out and went through cancer. Well, I didn't actually have to do chemotherapy, which was really wonderful because that is so life-changing and altering. So I had a lobectomy. And again, I just felt like, I didn't need the reminder to be grateful for life.
Yeah.
But again, I was very grateful to be here. Grateful to be in Australia where we have a health system that could support that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great to be, have found my community. Great to be reconnected with my dad and my brother and my family. And great to be in a place where I could say, you know, have people around me that I can get me through this.
Mm.
So that was really, yeah, that was really, really lucky. So it's a few years on now.
Wow. And so, like, during that time, that must have been, well, how did you feel also as a single mum? And I know you've just talked about your tribe, but managing your health
mm-hmm.
on top of potentially working and looking after your daughter, how was that for you?
It was tapping into a resilience that I didn't feel like I'd ever had to do before. Again, you know, and I've had some things happen that have had to do that. But I think for me, the hardest thing was, you know, I'm going to die.
Yeah.
I'm going to die and my child is going to be left alone.
Mm.
And that is scary for every parent, but it's scary for a single parent where there's no other option. And it was scary because she was so young and, you know, we're still seeing the effects of that with her
mm-hmm.
and her anxieties around yeah. because she had to grow up so quickly. You know, mm-hmm. I was in hospital for a few weeks. She had to stay with different people all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for a little girl who's been one-on-one with her mum for years now, like that was a lot. And,
yeah, and no more than 20 minutes away.
Exactly.
It's a lot.
I couldn't take a job to be 20 minutes away, but now I'm. But then I was in hospital, and she's very sure of herself and what she needed. And at the time, she said, "I'm not coming to the hospital."
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I said, "Okay."
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she just got on with her life. It was like we kind of didn't see each other for that time. I went to the hospital. I had my operation, and I recovered, and I did have complications. I ended up having pneumonia and lungs, yucky.
Everything else that comes with it.
All those things. But she just said, no, I'll see you when you get back, Mum.
Wow.
So she never saw you sick like that.
Yeah. And then I came home and I did have to go back to hospital. So she did then and see me, but it was like she just knew, like, I'm going to shut that off mm-hmm. and I'm going to
protect
myself and do what I need to do and you go do what you need to do and I'll see you when you get back.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
So she's very resilient.
She is.
Yeah.
And insightful.
And grown up and yeah. Yeah, wow. She's a kid that...
She's here to teach you lessons.
Oh.
She's seriously. Here to I'm getting chills thinking about it. Yeah.
Yeah. She's so aware of her maturity as well. Mm. I remember a time we were at the park and she was there with someone and there was these kids being just really silly. Like they were, boo, boo, bum, bum, all this, you know, silly kid stuff. And she looked at it and she said, I know I just can't be like that.
Yeah.
I'm not that type of kid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And have that real self-awareness.
Yeah. She knows who she is and she's a great kid. But she's been through a lot. I mean, she's moved countries. She's lived with a single mum. We lived in a little two-bedroom apartment and she's been that kid that she noticed really early on that our family was different.
Mm.
Other families had trampolines and other families had dogs and other families had spare bedrooms and other families all ate it together at the dinner table. And we didn't even have a dinner table at that time. There wasn't space for one. So she realised the difference.
Mm.
But she's always been really proud of who she is and she talks about that she's from Tanzania and... She considers herself a person of colour and she's got very fierce ideas about how the world is meant to be, you know. And interestingly now she has a dog and a trampoline. So she and another parent, you know, in my beautiful partner Nikki. So she's kind of got all those things, but I think there's something in me that's kind of making sure that she's okay with the difference. You don't have to be like everybody else.
Yeah.
Do you feel like... Melbourne, Australia is catching up to the difference.
Mm. Yeah, I think that the Melbourne now, even 7 years later, is different to the Melbourne I first arrived back to. And look, not all Melbourne. I'm reminded when I go to different places that I'm not always as perhaps accepted or as welcomed as others. As a queer rainbow family. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
That surprises me, to be honest.
I know, because we live in a little bubble.
Yeah. We do. metro, inner city.
We really do live in a little bubble. Look, I'm not going to say that I've had people yell abuse at me or anything like that, but I've certainly had the looks and the scoffs. Thankfully, I'm 6 foot one and my partner's 6 foot, so bring it on, I say. I mean,
and this fierce kid by your side.
And this fierce kid. And it's funny, she's really fierce, but she's also like, we call her the health and safety officer. Like, she's very aware of risk, and she'll see someone out of the corner of her eye, and she'll cross the street if she sees someone that she doesn't think that she can trust.
She's got those instincts.
So I definitely do think, Dash, that Melbourne is evolving really quickly.
Yeah.
Maybe not as quickly as it should or as it could have, but it is. And I think that's this testament to people are open to learning and open to growing and open to difference, and we're curious.
Can I ask you a question around that? Because I have a lot of things about DEI at the moment because of what's happening in America, where that stuff has been shut down.
Yeah.
Do you feel it's coming into Australia? Like, I feel for myself, I felt with the government that we just elected, maybe we're not going that way. But how do you feel about that, as in that community?
I think that we, with the Labor government continuing to be in power, I think we made a bit of a statement in Australia, and I'm really, really proud of us.
Yeah.
I'm really proud of us. And whatever your, you know, the one thing that I've noticed in Australia, that no matter what your political party you vote for, we do still have this sense that everyone is welcome.
A fair go.
And a fair go. Yeah. And like, oh, yeah, you know, I remember someone saying, oh, so you're a lesbian now. Oh, that's all right, I guess. you're a good girl. You're a good person, you know. And so at a personal level, we're really like, oh, yeah, he's a good bloke and whatever. Yeah. But at a systemic level, I don't think we're there yet. You know, you've still got, you know, people of colour are the most represented in our prison system. You've got First Nations people who don't have the rights and the respect that they deserve. You've got, you know, queer people and trans people that are still being abused. You've got Muslim women being abused in the street for wearing hijab. Like, we're not there yet, but I think at a personal level, we say, hi, how are you? Mm. How's your day? Mm. You know, I want that to be bigger and broader and more connected and more collective.
And I think that's such a beautiful way of saying it, because I do think it's those individual connections and personal level understanding that then does change the systems. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, like, I remember when I came to Australia, I was the only brown kid in my primary school.
Where did you go to school?
Mount Waverley, Glen Waverley area. Mm. That is now one of the most multicultural suburbs. But, like, we were one of the first families, brown kids' families. And I think when something isn't as expected and people have ideas about who you might be, it's only through relationship that they start to understand, actually, we have more in common than not. And then that starts to trickle up.
Absolutely.
But there's still people who are so sheltered from people who are different from them. Mm-hmm. And so if they don't end up having those connections, then that can be a really, I guess, challenging place for them to try and understand why society is having these conversations in the first place.
And at a bigger level, it's dangerous.
Yeah.
We should be forced to get to know people that are different from us.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think we were talking about before we started recording that you guys met during the Williamson Community Leadership Program, and you said you never would have met.
Nah. I don't hang out with dentists.
A dentist and an academic, you know, different generations, different backgrounds, you know, I feel like, and now you guys are close and best friends, you know, like, so you have to go into spaces where you find other people that are not like you, and you have to, but you have to be curious and you have to be open to that. And some people aren't. People are afraid, because I think we've been told to fear things that are different to us, and I just ultimately was not raised like that. Mm. And I think my confidence that we talked about, the confidence to go and do different things, has meant that I've do different things. And the more different things you do and the more spaces you go into, the more you go, oh, I can go anywhere and I can meet anyone and I can relate to people and I can talk about human things.
And maybe going back to what you'd spoken about before, where we were trying to work out, is it confidence, is it arrogance, is it fearlessness? And we were kind of saying, oh, confidence is when you've done something before so you can know you can do it again. What you've done before is the unknown, right? So you know you can go into the unknown, or you can go into places that are different, or you can connect with people. So regardless if the situation is different.
Yeah, and I think as well, the one thing that I was taught is to listen to your instincts.
Yeah.
And that's something now that I really am quite harsh on when it's raising a child, is like, I do a lot of things for her, I must admit. But I also want to say, like, what do you think?
Mm. Yeah.
And she's very instinctual. Mm. And that's something I think that is important, because you don't always have your phone to Google. You don't always have, you know, this thing about kids, giving kids phones as well. Like, that's a whole nother podcast. But what do you think you should do right now? Mm. Which way should you go? What decision should you make? Who should you talk to? And instincts are not always going to keep us from doing things. I think they're going to allow us to lean into things.
Yeah. Yeah.
I should go and say hi to that person.
Yeah.
I should ask that guy on the bus how his day was. Mm. You know, that's my instinct.
Yeah. So you mentioned the fact that, you know, Fiona and I from doing Williamson, yes. And you now work at Leadership Victoria. Tell us a little bit about what you do and maybe what Leadership Victoria does.
Yeah. Leadership Victoria has been around for 35 years. So we've been running the Williamson Community Leadership Program for 35 years. And really it's been about bringing leaders from different parts of Victorian context, so business, government, not-for-profit, community sector, different places, bringing them together and taking them on a journey of leadership development, but also understanding themselves, you know, allowing the Fionas and the Dashas to find each other, to connect, to create a podcast out of it. You know, like, what can we do to make this world better if we bring people together and we allow them to become great adaptive leaders? You know, because we're all leaders, as we know. Leadership is an action. It's not a title. I've never waited for someone to give me the title to act as a leader. So I've been at Leadership Victoria for 12 months now. I am the partnerships lead, and I kind of like to say I'm just the relationship person. You know, at a personal level, at a business level, at an organizational level, I'm the person who wants to bring people together for the right reasons. And if that means that you register to go do one of our short course programs, or you're interested in doing Williamson Community Leadership Program, then I'm the gal. I'm the person that you're going to talk to. Yeah, so that's my job. And I, you know, with a marketing background and, you know, safari company background, like, what do you even say about that? Like, I've just had this life that now I feel like I can talk to anyone. Mm. I can go into a situation and say, hi.
I just can't think of anyone better to do it, to be completely honest.
Well, I hope that that's what my CEO thought when she interviewed me as well. But, and I had never done this role before, but it feels, again, like I've met my tribe, I've met my people, I'm in the right place. I'm in the right place and I'm doing the right things, and everything feels really aligned, congruent at the moment, which is good.
And it's a space where you could go to people and go, hi, and they'll go, hi, back.
Yeah, they will. Yeah, 100%. And I was just thinking, you know, one of the things I valued from going through Leadership Victoria's program was, it wasn't a focus on becoming like this individual superstar. It was about collective leadership and like listening to collective cultures and collective like ways of being. Do you feel like that was maybe part of what drew you to this?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, we what's that saying? I wish I could remember, but it's like, you go alone, you only go so far, you go together and you can really make something happen.
Yeah.
We know that through activism and impact work and venture capital, all these sorts of things, if you do it together, it makes real impact. Mm. And so if at Leadership Victoria, you know, if we're giving leaders the development, the capacity building that they need to learn how to be collective, to collaborate, to build relationship beyond the borders of their bubble or their workplace or their silo in their organization, then we're going to be able to make greater changes and a bigger effect of what we need, you know.
Because I felt with Leadership Victoria, when I've had dealings with them before, it's not about the bottom line or how much cash you're going to make or how successful your business is going to be. The success comes because of what you do in your community and what you do for your people who work for you and building that. And I don't know how to explain it better than that. It's just, it's an extraordinary community. Yeah, and there's so much more to it. There's so much more to it.
So much more. I mean, I think about all the studies that come out around diverse workplaces are more
productive, successful,
yeah. profitable, whatever word you want to use. Yeah. You know, we know that diversity breeds innovation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's new ideas. If you're listening to the unusual voices in the room, you're getting a broader view, you know. Mm. So a leader, wherever you've come from, if you value that, you're going to have a more productive team. Yeah. You're going to have people who are happy that they're being met at an empathetic level, that they're being understood, that, you know, they've got growth, they're able to grow. So, yeah, I feel like that's really what we're trying to do. And that's, I guess in some way, that's what I've always tried to do, you know. How do we, whether it was the young porter that came to me, you know, when I started working in at the safari company and said, I'm going to be a leader one day, I'm going to be a guide. And he could hardly speak English. And 6 years later, he's climbing the mountain, leading Americans up there. You know, like, you got to recognize that people want to move on and change and grow and be curious to that. And a good leader will always be curious to the stories of those around them.
With your programs that you do, it's not even just about the leader, it's about building leaders as
Absolutely.
Well, isn't it?
Yeah, so we have programs that, short course programs for emerging leaders, our Igniting Leadership program. We have a mid-level program, which it's really hard to define the mid-level program. Like, are you in the middle of your career? Well, I don't know how long my career is going to be, but we define that by saying you're leading, but you're also still being led. You know, you're leading a team and you've got experience leading, but you're still learning how to be a leader because you've still got people above you. So we have a three-day program that's around, it's kind of like a little bit of a, what's that iOS update? Like, it's a plug-in. It's an update to your leadership capacity. And so we have that program. Then we have Williamson, which is obviously our flagship program that every year we take on about 45, 46 individuals that are going to go on that long journey, as you both did.
Yeah.
It must be extraordinary seeing people at the start of that and then seeing them at the end. Like, the change is, I mean, it's incredible for some people. Like, it really is.
It really is. And I've had people, obviously I haven't been around to see a full iteration. At the end of 2026, I feel like I'm going to be really able to say, like, this is what's happened, because I'm having conversations right now with people that are going to go into the program in 2026 and then they're going to finish in 2026 and I would have seen all the change.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I've had people come to me and said, my wife hated it when I did Williamson, but at the end she said, you're a better husband now.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
You're a better husband and you're a better father.
Yeah.
Now, if we're, I mean, I'm not saying you have to go and pay $20,000 to become a better father to do that, but that's the byproduct. We're creating experiences that allow individuals to grow.
Yeah, because that's the thing. It's not just about business. It's the personal growth, which is quite extraordinary inside it. A lot of them are business savvy already. They know what they're doing, but it's the other side that they have no idea they needed to develop to be better, like home and work and friend and everything else.
Yeah.
And also society member, because that's the other thing I didn't realize with the programs is how much you learn outside of your own bubble, if that makes sense. And sometimes, like, I mean, I'll be different to you two. I didn't realise how much of my own bubble I was in until I did Williamson, and then, God, just saw so much outside of myself of what's going on and realised my privilege, you know, just extraordinary, those sorts of experiences, which I don't know if you, as a dentist, that you'd normally get in a workplace, you know what I mean?
No, because technically you've just been trained to be technically very good at your job. You have to do some peopling every now and again, but you've got to be good at your job, and then all of a sudden you've got to find this adaptive leadership style that is that is human, that is about relationships. So it's very much an experience like that.
And I need to be more empathetic, I think.
I've definitely heard that as well. Yeah. And just curious of others, curious of what else other people are going on about. And that bigger picture, you know, that concept of stepping up onto the balcony.
Yeah.
Mm.
So we're all on the dance floor, we're doing things, and I feel like sometimes as a, you know, working parent, you're on the dance floor a lot. And you're just like, really, you're doing the dance. But sometimes you've got to step up and go, okay, what's really happening here?
Yeah.
And then that plays out in workplaces and leaders and groups and community organisations and all sorts of things, you know.
And it's even just learning that concept to do that, to, because so often you're on that dance floor and you can't even like get out of your own head. And when you've learnt that concept about, oh God, I've got to step away from this and look down, but you don't get that in the workplace, you know. That's not something that you do learn.
Well, we don't allow ourselves to find space for that because we're so busy. We're so busy. But even that concept of the dance floor, I will also liken that to, you know, you dance on the dance floor next to the people that dance like you.
True.
So who's over dancing in a really cool different way? You know, who's over in the corner not dancing?
Exactly.
Who's standing on the outside because they can't get in to the dance floor? Like, I think of that. Maybe that's my nightclub days coming back.
I like that. I never thought of it that way.
And so I think about it like that as well. Like, I'm just dancing with my cool friends over here, but then there's all these other cool people over there dancing a different way. And I want to get on the balcony and have a picture of all of that.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
That's a really great way to think about it, yeah.
Well, we have just heard an extraordinary life story, and I know you haven't finished yet.
No.
There's still a lot of living to come.
So much.
But I'm just wondering if you have advice for people who may be in that space of living life where they feel like they might not be fitting in, or they're not quite sure who they are, or they're having a bit of a reawakening or rethinking their identity. What would you tell them?
I feel like that's like when you're feeling stuck, you know, and to get unstuck, you know, you have to be open, you have to be reflective, and sometimes you have to just dig deep and step outside. You know, you've got to, it's not always easy to get unstuck and to find your people. But I mean, I don't really have one really articulate line to say, but I just feel like you got to keep going. For me, in the periods where I was were dark and were feeling like, what's going to come out of this? I just kept thinking, I've just got to keep putting one foot in front of the other.
Yeah.
It sounds so cliche, but it really is. Wake up and do the next right thing, the next good thing, the next positive thing. You know, Frozen, Elsa, the cartoon, she says, do the next right thing. And I think there's something really, really good in that. Like, what is the next right thing that you could do? And whether it's making the phone call to the recruiter that you're a bit afraid to do because you don't really know if you want to do that job, or if it's about, you know, signing up for that networking event, or if it's about, you know, saying hi to the man on the bus that you know really needs you to say hi to them, or just looking up and looking out and not looking down and inward, you know, starting to think about, well, what do I have? What are the resources that I have that I can tap into, and how is that going to get me to the next right thing?
Yeah.
Because what I'm hearing is it's the small steps. It's not a giant leap. It's the small steps that get you further.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And some people do get to take the giant leaps, and that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And that's, for whatever reason that is, you know, that's great. But I think for a lot of times when you're feeling stuck, you can't take a big giant leap. You can't just get on a plane to Tanzania and take a big giant leap. But sometimes you can, and that's great. You know, I feel really, really privileged that I got to have that experience, because it certainly made me who I am. But my life now is much more about small steps and looking up and looking out and digging into, well, what do I really want? You know, I've built this new life. I've almost built a new person. You know, like I am a new person, but I'm still the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now you're teaching others.
Yeah, and I'm giving, you know, I'm trying to give back to the community, and I'm working in an organisation that I love, and I'm building relationships. And it's not always easy. Sometimes it's messy. People aren't always clean cut and normal, and, you know, we're all just doing the best that we can. I think that was on a podcast I listened to a while ago, and it really it's just a concept that we're all just doing the best that we can. And if you remember that, then I don't know, maybe you'll be a bit nicer.
Hi, Fiona here. Thanks for taking the time to listen to the XYZ Experiment podcast. And don't forget to leave a rating and review. If you enjoyed our show, tell all your friends and family and subscribe. Follow us on Instagram at the XYZ Experiment for all the latest updates and news. Our original music was composed and performed by Luke Champion.